What is this about today? Basically, in one or two sentences, making data in AI work without sending data to some API that belongs to a different country or mostly the United States. And I want to show you how this can be done without a lot of complexity and perhaps much simpler than these large cloud-only systems. Briefly about myself, I'm on one side working with Magenta for parts of my day. When I'm working with research institutions and sometimes speaking at places like here or other conferences, if you want to connect, you have multiple places to reach out. So data processing systems have mainly been SQL based. I mean, people discovered recently, like many years ago, that mainframes are not so cool without SQL. And then eventually they moved to data warehouses. And one thing that data warehouses have in common is basically they are built on top of SQL. In the journey of making things scale more and more, we forgot it initially a little bit about SQL and, let's say, user ergonomics, but we came back to that quite recently with Hive and Spark and the cloud data warehouses after 2015 or something like that, made this scale and more easily accessible for a broader audience. Examples of these systems are Snowflake or BigQuery. But after recent geopolitical tensions rising between US and Europe, more and more people are discussing about a cloud exit. In any case, I'm quite convinced that SQL is here to stay, and today you should, or after this presentation, should know how you can easily use SQL for your systems without a lot of complexity, but in a way that still scales. Most of the data sets that we work with have this type of size or that type of size. Is there anyone in this room that is working with petabyte-sized data sets? Kerstin? Oh, one person. Anyone else? Second person. So for these two people, it might be that this talk is not applicable, but it depends. Because if you let's briefly jump to this slide here, data accumulates over time, and perhaps the data that you care about, the particular partition, is small enough so that you again land in this land or that land of data that you really care about. And then the content is very much applicable for you as well. So a lot of the data that we work with has some medium size, or at least the recent part that we care about for analysis has a reasonably sized, in the range of a couple of terabytes. This usually means it's too large for traditional systems like Postgres and too small to justify a very complex data infrastructure. As already showed before, data that we care about accumulates over time, and it can get really, really large, maybe into the amounts of petabytes for some. But the data that we actually want to analyze or that we care about is usually much smaller. Think about logs. And then anomalies usually just care about the anomalies and not the whole data set. Local data has some interesting properties. On one side, it gives you reduced latency, so you can give more snappy results for, let's say, BI consumers, more interactive, more real-time results, and you have more control with regards to quality and privacy. And local may not mean just on this laptop, but it could be a Kubernetes cluster that is scaling the node local processing per partition, perhaps. So what is DuckDB? I guess a lot of people in this room have heard about it, and it might be well known, but it is a system sitting in this analytical area of embedded databases. What are the properties of this system? It's quite fast. It is vectorized, because this makes it fast. It is actually a real database, so unlike tools like Polars or this data frame world, it has a proper memory manager. It has asset means of consistency, so it can be actually a real database. It offers flexible I/O, so unlike systems like Oracle, where you cannot get data into the system with the system itself, you need something on the side. DuckDB can actually talk to the outside world, and we will see in a couple of minutes what this might mean. And it has a very vibrant ecosystem for extensions. So for things that your data scientists might fancy, like identity resolution and fuzzy text search, and we pull the data into R or Pandas. Actually, with DuckDB, you have some native add-ons that can do it right inside the database. And the query syntax is way more ergonomic. So before we dive into the syntax, maybe you like the UI. I find it really neat to quickly profile data sets, and it's super easy to get started with it, but just as a gimmick on the side. So if you want to explore DuckDB, we just install DuckDB and run it. We first create some tables. I hope it is large enough so you can see it even in the back. And then this is pretty standard SQL. I guess I don't have to explain it in this round, just basically defining the table, inserting some data. But now we want to find the largest top three records per group. In a traditional database, we would use a window function. We might partition by the grouping thing and then sort the data. What happens is, on one side, the SQL is really large and long, not so easy to reason about as a human, and perhaps also for vibe coders as an LLM. But maybe even more importantly than that is we trigger behind the scenes a total ordering per group, so something which is not so optimized, and the query optimizer cannot make this go away easily. With DuckDB, however, we can reformulate the same SQL query to something like this. On one side, this is shorter and more easy to write. And then the flip side, it's also faster to execute because the optimizer has some specific optimizations to run queries like that. And by the way, for group by clauses, we just can group by all. We don't have to specify all the columns that we don't want to hand code, which is super annoying and sometimes error prone if the query changes. I talked about direct IO before. Here's one example where we can basically read a remote Parquet file and bring it into the database without any interaction and further other tools. So again, one more point driving the simplicity of DuckDB. Here, two examples. One, the data scientist example with fuzzy search directly in the database by using RapidFuzz. And above, the example for the data engineers that want to read data from Kafka. DuckDB can directly connect also to Kafka and then bring you some records into your world. I know some people in this room are interested in graph queries. Here's the example which shows how you could even do that inside of DuckDB in a very, very scalable way. You can basically create your tables again. This is here people and other things. And then you can basically traverse this graph with pretty much normal Cypher queries. So you get something like Neo4j more or less in a cheaper and more efficient way for analyzing the graph. What does it mean? Is everything good? Are there some downsides? Well, perhaps what changes? I think quite a lot changes because people are usually used to having this one single central system that does the identity and access management, perhaps dynamic data filtering and whatnot. And this is all different with DuckDB. So you do not have something like user management with DuckDB itself, but you would put the data in the way how you want to share it, perhaps anonymized or somehow prepared that others can see it or only the subset that they should see. And then you could hand this DuckDB file over to someone. From a perspective of a lawyer, this is great because it's very clear. From a perspective of a data engineer that now has to run maybe multiple pipelines, one for each masking and anonymization category, it's maybe a little bit a way to rethink things. Because access control is really managed via the storage layer. The interesting thing is you can scale this system using Lambda functions massively and very cheaply if you want to do that. And it's just a transformation engine, so you do not have to persistently allocate resources. However, there is also a, let's say, vendor behind it that gives you easy means to do something like that in a very cheap way if you want to have that. Talking about the BI side of things, because it implements the ADBC, not JDBC for rows, but Arrow database protocol for columns, gives you faster BI applications. There are some new ones that develop around Arrow Flight, and yeah, they can give you more snappy visualizations. And around Aeroflight, we had some new developments like BoilStream for even faster streaming ingestion. You don't have to necessarily worry about too much about your Kafka clusters here anymore, but get something that is quite a neat system. You get latency reduction based on this Aero database protocol. One of these possible vendors is, for example, RIL. The main challenge that you have with DuckDB is it's its biggest constraint. You have a single writer. With Oracle or Postgres, people are always used to have multiple processes attaching to the database, and then somehow they collaborate on this shared state. With DuckDB, you can attach only a single writer to a database. So how can we change this, perhaps? The first and most reasonable step is to pair two worlds together and say we have Postgres. That's very established. It can do the IAM. It has standard processes to execute in the enterprise. And we have DuckDB, which can be very neat and perhaps fast. In this example, we want to again read the table from like before from the S3 file. And we can simply run in Postgres with this add-on, the DuckDB query, and create a table inside of Postgres that now has all the data. And now it's a normal Postgres table, and we can access it. So possibly, if you have some long-running and then complex aggregations, you might just read from your Postgres table, aggregate in DuckDB, and write the result back to Postgres. And for a lot of people, this can solve many data problems. For some in this room, however, this way of scaling is not enough. And to understand what means not enough, we have to understand what are the components of a database. So from a, let's say, high-level perspective, we have obviously something about storing data, file format, usually column-oriented nowadays, the table format, a storage engine, some compute to actually do something with the data, and a catalog for the metadata. For the last years, especially when it was about going to the clouds, making things cheaper, we built data lakes. And basically, we ripped out a couple of things to make things cheap and scalable. And it totally worked to the extent until GDPR came or until people wanted to do streaming data and had some stateful mutation. And eventually, people figured out it would make sense to work with a lakehouse that has the idea of basically still being cheap, but retaining the scalability and getting a database back. So bringing state mutation back into the picture. What does this mean? So basically not just having files in an object store, but some kind of additional metadata on top. So people developed the open table formats, Iceberg, Delta, Hoodie, and then a couple of catalogs on top. Iceberg is a really popular catalog, so let's better understand Iceberg here. Until very recent, S3 was not fully consistent. So a catalog like Iceberg had to implement, let's say, workarounds to actually be feasible when they wanted to reflect consistent writes to the system. So they basically added an internal database with some API to reflect these changes. So it is more or less like a database in disguise with less features because you cannot speak full-blown SQL to it. And the interesting catch is it doesn't have global transactions. The transactions in Iceberg and Delta and so on are always per table, so not global. This brings somewhat a lot of complexity. And the interesting thing is these table formats like Iceberg were specifically designed to work as something that does not need a database. And now internally, they build something like a database. This is an interesting thing to think about. But it supports somewhat SQL. So what is different with DuckLake? We were talking about DuckDB before, about the limitations, how we can solve them by adding pgDuckDB into the mix. But with DuckLake, we can get something like Iceberg, but with the simplicity of DuckDB. So this is built and centered around database first design. So SQL and the database are the core thing. And basically, we have two databases and files. The real database for the catalog, and then the files, and then the database for the processing. It is an open standard. You can actually choose the backends for Postgres, SQLite, or DuckDB. For storage, you can choose many, like local file system, S3 compatible, and many more. And the interesting thing that you get is obviously reduced complexity. You get real asset transactions across tables for the whole system. And you can easily manage your data. So your keys for encryption will stay in the catalog, but the encrypted files might even reside on public S3 files. And for the people that here are into streaming, Duck Lake supports data inlining. So you can say after N records, push out the data to object stores. Traditional streaming systems have a bit of a challenge with small files. Here, the small files never happen because basically the small files stay in the normal database and they are flushed out to object store when they get too large. And this happens fully automatically, fully transactional. So this might even simplify a lot of streaming architectures. So put it in different terms. On the left side, we see what Iceberg is. And on the right side, we see all the reduced complexity and what is Duck Lake. But how does it feel like? So again, we start DuckDB like before. We have to install Duck Lake to use it. And then we have to start Duck Lake. So as I told you, we have to create a metadata database. And we basically attach to this metadata database with it a name. And from there on, we are basically using Duck Lake. So there's not a lot to change to move to Duck Lake. So this here is just a normal SQL to create a table, insert some values, and then show some data. So this is all there is to get started with Duck Lake. We can also delete records, like you would normally be able to do that from a database. And we also have transactions. So if we delete data here, but then roll back the transaction, the data is still here. So it really behaves like a normal database. But behind the scenes, this scalable thing that we could know already from the Iceberg ecosystem without the complexity. Also, features that some of us have learned to love from the Iceberg ecosystem, like snapshots and then this query at a specific snapshot revision, this is all part of the game. The same goes for compacting files, for example. There are management functions behind the scenes to reduce small files on the storage layer or delete no longer needed revisions. The Duck-like that I showed you in this minimal example was using DuckDB for the catalog and DuckDB for the processing. If you want to share this catalog to many people, you may or may not want to use DuckDB itself as a catalog. Basically, you would again face the restriction of a single writer. Possibly, and most likely, if you're in an enterprise, you want to share your catalog with multiple people or applications. In that case, you would use Postgres as the catalog, and then as the object store, whatever you have. In this example here, I have, for example, a Minero thing that gives me a local S3. This is the transitioning part now. I want to briefly touch on what means data orchestration, because to go from data processing on Duck Lake to AI, we somehow need to fuse these two things together. And this is what orchestrators do, because the best engine, like in a Ferrari, as solely the engine, like Oracle perhaps some years ago, does not allow us to go from A to B. We might have to ingest some data, we might have to add some AI and whatnot to it to actually build a whole journey or user experience into the system. In this particular example, I will show how this can be done with Dexter to bridge these worlds. And I like to compare it as a calculator for crunching numbers, because Dexter allows you to work with data dependencies not as problems, but actually as features. And because now the computer has a data structure to reason about, it will allow you to do some interesting things where you can attach tests to the individual assets or perhaps run them on specific cadences without worrying. In a large system with, let's say, hundreds or thousands of assets, in a task-based system, you have to really figure out what are the data dependencies, what tasks are writing first, what afterwards. It's a bit of a mess to get this right. But here with a graph, the computer can reason about pieces in the subgraph, and if they refreshed, then can update the other stuff as needed. One small example to bring something into Dexter, like a hello world, we can just annotate a function with asset, and that's pretty much it. We might have a second function, and that depends on the output of assets, and that gives us the graph that we see on the right side. So also here, not so much complexity to get started. The interesting thing, what we get, is when we compare task-based versus asset-based orchestration. So as said before, we can add tests to the individual things in the graph. So we can really test the specific nodes that we care about instead of running the global transformation and maybe then figuring out behind the scenes and with manual thoughts, how can we test the individual things. Here it's a neat framework, not only for quality checks, for anomaly tests as well, and for recency checks. Let's come to the third element, and that is language models. A lot of people know large language models, but the trend in the industry is going to, obviously for very large models, still to grow larger, but for people that want to automate processes in a reliable way, to look into the domain of small language models. Because you want to know if the thinking tokens decreased. You don't want to have a human sitting in the loop and chatting with a system, but you want to have something that is fully automated that you can trust. And it's okay if there are some AI pieces in there, but you want to have some element of control for your infrastructure. And you may want to actually, or are forced to have certain compliance. So for some people, there can be a hype train that is crashing, and I will show you in the coming minutes how we can basically integrate these pieces into a neat, coherent system. When working with AI, you may need actual hardware, not just a laptop, maybe two, maybe real servers, maybe on Kubernetes or cluster. By using a system like Ray, you can combine the power of the multiple compute nodes. Ray is pretty much like Spark. I guess Spark is well known in this round, but Spark is more for data processing and not so well suited for machine learning. Ray is sort of a Spark pendant for machine learning. The nice thing about Ray is it not only works well for batch workloads, but if you have a use case that has to work with real-time model inference, Ray offers also components for that. So, for example, around vLLM and many GPUs, you can easily build your own OpenAI-compatible interface if you want to do that for real-time inference. What I'm going to show here is more something around batch inference, because a lot of data use cases just want to spin up the resources only when it's needed. And the interesting thing with Ray is we can spin these up on a cluster of nodes. Perhaps if you're on Kubernetes, you might use spot instances in the node pool, and then just make this scale as much as you need. Here in this demo, I will just spin up a local Ray cluster, and this is also fine. And gives some unique benefits, because I always think it's really important to make the system also scale down, because otherwise it's really hard to debug or onboard new people on the team. So I want to show a small example. First, how can we use DuckLake? For this, we want to ingest some data. We will use a tool, it's called DLT. And at the point in writing, it did not even have a proper DuckLake integration. I want to show you how easy it is to integrate a new thing into DuckLake. And then for the AI demo, we will look into two showcases. One is a speech recognition case to basically translate recorded audio into text. And the second one is for document processing. Many people here work on RAG cases where you want to feed, let's say, PDF documents to the LLM for indexing. This is usually not an easy process. You have to really prepare the documents to be accessible for the LLMs. We will use DocLink as a system to extract the layout structure and make it accessible in neat plain markdown. Let's dive right in. So, well, how do you add DuckLake to something we didn't talk to DuckLake before? I have created an integration. It is also Do you want to have it bigger or what? Can I don't zoom in. It's a browser, so let me check if I can do Control Plus. No, somehow this doesn't zoom in. Yeah, but this works. Oh. Okay. But this seems to work. So, how can we add a duck lake? I created an integration package. It is actually open source. It's on PyPy. You can test it out. And this gives you a connection provider for a DuckDB-backed system. It works either with file-based or with DuckLake-based systems. And you can basically just, in the case of DAX, say, hey, give me this resource, and then configure it elsewhere. And you might have two targets, one for local, that might be a DuckLake or just a DuckDB file, and one for production with a Postgres catalog and, let's say, a MinIO or S3, Amazon S3 backend as the storage. We'll give you a function like this, and that within this function, you can basically then run the query on the database. And it's basically as simple as that. So I have to zoom out a little bit. I hope you can still read it. This shows you the configuration. So for the more real scenario, you would have to specify the connection details for the Postgres database and for the S3 thing, basically. In my case, I'm not using Amazon, but a local MinIO. You would have to specify the URL and a couple of credentials. On the DuckDB side, because we're using Postgres, we have to actually load these add-ons here in DuckLake as well. Now, this is the details that make this resource work. So basically, we're loading this configuration and we're preparing DuckLake, where certain, let's say, SQL statements have to be executed to load the right secrets. And this is happening behind the scenes. And the result is a fully equipped connection. And this connection now is something that we can feed over into DLT. So DLT here has a configuration to ingest some Pokemons, because they're a nice example. And it has basically a couple of Pokemons here. So to converge them over, we first of all want to integrate this into DuckLake. And here in line 14, we basically call again this getEngine function. So this will give us the SQL Alchemy backend that in our case is now DuckLake enabled. But because it's a standard compliant SQL thing or target, DLT will now do whatever it is doing, but now it runs on DuckLake. And I think this is a really interesting thing to see how easy it is to integrate other new tools that might not yet officially support DuckLake. Let's look into a second example. Small language models here for speech recognition. I know this is a data engineering round, but I guess a lot of people have heard about Hugging Face models and maybe have even executed or run some of them on their own. So basically, Hugging Face is a place like Maven Central or GitHub where you can upload and share these machine learning models, and then others can download and use them. You may even, if you pay the money, get some GPUs to inference the models in the cloud. If you want to use a model from Hugging Face, there's always some explanation on how to run it. Here in this particular example, I'm looking at Whisper Large version 3 Turbo. And basically, we have this auto model thing that just instantiate from this pre-trained model. And that's pretty much almost it. This is the constructor that we have to implement. So we just tell the thing to download the model when it starts and use the standard infrastructure for inferencing that model. And we have another function that we have to create. It's called transcribe. And there we actually have to prepare the audio, move it over to an accelerator device, and then call the more or less predict function of that model. In this particular case, it's called pipe, because it's using these transformer pipelines in the background. And to use it, we basically now have this nice class that we can instantiate, and we call this transcribe function. Let me show you how this would look like If we try this. So I have prepared. Yes. I will make it bigger. Much, much bigger. So it is loading the model into memory. In my case, it's a Mac, and it has some, not NVIDIA GPUs, but something that's called MPS for neural engine accelerated things. It's actually quite fast. And now it's basically starting to load this all into memory and then run this predict function of the model. And in around 30 seconds, this 3-minute audio will be processed and we will see the audio on that screen. So this is a speech of Obama, not super interesting, but a cool demo. And here you see it takes basically 20 seconds to do this processing. And the interesting thing is we do not have to send data to some other API. Actually, we can run this easily on a Kubernetes cluster or machine that we control that is already compliant. And I think people often overestimate the complexity to make something like this happen in production. But this was just running on my computer. It has limited capacity. So how can we bring this over to Ray to scale this? So for Ray, we can reuse this class, but we have to, let's say, create a small amount, but a very limited amount of boilerplate code to scale this. So we again create a new class. It is then basically redirecting to the existing one, and that's it. And when we have something like a, I like to call it a better version of a for loop, that is using this mapper class. Why does it make sense to have this better version of a for loop? Because if you truly want to scale, you may process a lot of files and they might not have the same length. Perhaps you want to have some more intelligent, let's call it sharding, where all the small files go onto some nodes and then the large files might go to separate dedicated nodes to overall ensure swift processing of all the data. And then we have to basically define one more function to actually construct the data set. It is a distributed data set, so we feed the normal file path from the shell to Ray. Ray has this shared memory, and then it will basically something that is accessible to all the nodes in the cluster. For the demo, this is just a single computer, but the interesting thing is you can basically just by changing a single line of configuration in Ray, make the whole system retarget not just a laptop, but a whole cluster that you might have available. So for the small variation of running this in Ray, we can now run basically this particular function as a payload, and then we would be scaled. So if we just run on this local node, we just init the Ray, so it starts a local Ray cluster, and from here on, the whole thing is the same as before. But now if we have multiple files, it would be nicely using all the available resources. And if we have actually not just in it a local cluster, but a distributed cluster, we would be using all the resources in that cluster. I was talking about, we want to bring this to Dagster, right? So how would this integration look like if we bring this into the orchestrator? It's basically the same code we have seen before, now annotated with this asset. So for running on a Ray cluster, we want to actually have a Ray cluster resource. And this is basically the file thing that we have seen before. Here, I have added a little bit of metadata because observability is great. We may want to know how much seconds have been processed. I have prepared already a running Dagster instance with some very nice icons which show us what is going on here. We're using Hugging Face models, it's running on PyTorch, and we use Ray for parallelization. In Dagster, we can basically select this particular asset and click materialize, and then look at the run. So behind the scenes, we will now see Ray starting up. And then the same process that we have seen before is going to happen. The model will be loaded into memory and the transcription will begin. So we don't have to wait, but I think it is good to see how easy it is to basically bridge now from a small script that is working in isolation to something that is working in a production-grade pipeline in a whole end-to-end orchestrated workflow. And let's continue here. I was talking about the rag case before. So why would you want to pre-process with documents? You might have complex visual structures, tables, and other really hard things that the LLMs do not understand, but people want to chat with the data. So some people use Unstruct and other services in the cloud to actually make this accessible. But if you want to work in an air-gapped environment and have RAG of high quality, you need something else. Here, I'm using Dockling. Dockling is an open source project that is now from the Linux Foundation. IBM is supporting it. And it's sort of a wrapper to many Hugging Face models. And they published recently some really own interesting VLMs to process the data. We will be in this showcase not using the VLMs, but we will be using RapidOSIA and some of the paddle models for doing the processing. So basically, we have the same story as before. We have to tell the thing to actually initialize this function. In here, it's called document converter. And we later want to, well, call the convert function on the document. In a real setting, you may want to specify some additional options, like what model to choose and what not. In our case, what is relevant, because we're running on Ray, we would like to actually maybe initially initialize the pipeline so that on that particular node, the model is downloaded and made accessible, and then begin with the processing of perhaps more than one document in parallel on that worker node. So let's quickly look at how this might work. Let me see if I have to quickly find my demo code. And get it from here, so it's easier to copy paste. So again, we are starting the process like before. We see a couple of logs. The models are loaded. Again, the accelerator is used, and we are processing some specific document here. This is a pattern of chemical molecules in this particular case. So it has a lot of visual things and also some tables which might be otherwise hard to understand for the LLM. Currently, the output is configured to be of Markdown. So after a very short time, we should actually see a neat Markdown structure here that has the full text and the layout preserved, so the table, the heading structure, the tables, and so on, nicely accessible in plain Markdown. This makes it This particular style of structuring the document makes it really accessible for a RAG system. We would, however, still have to refine this to be, let's say, the best quality RAG, like think about chunking, use maybe layout-aware chunking and whatnot, or graph layout chunking. But this already works, gives us solves many problems. And in the same way as shown before, we can basically create an actor for Ray and wrap it again. I will be a bit faster because it gets boring if it's always the same thing. But we have to, again, create this for loop and so on. And then we can run this on the Ray cluster. So we can basically just call this map batches function, specify the resources that you want to use, and then parallelize the execution of this function. And the same goes for the integration with Dagster. So by now, you know, we have to add the asset. The rest is more or less the same. We have to inject the resource, so actually we know what Ray cluster we want to execute on. Is it the local one? Is it the remote one on Kubernetes? And from there, we just basically, as a payload, have more or less the main function from before. For the Ray resource configuration, how does it look like? So for the very small system that is not running on Kubernetes, you can really go and simply just call the init, and that's it. If you want to run on Kubernetes, you may want to have something like a templated version to make it accessible for production use cases. So Kubernetes, it's a distributed system. You may want to assign specific amount of RAM or GPUs to the head node or worker nodes, use spot instances or not, or fall back from spot instances to other instances and node pools and have the right sized hardware there. So depending on how complex you want to get, this Kubernetes YAML or JSON will have some sense of complexity. However, you can actually template this nicely with factory methods in Python and give it to your data scientist. May just feed a couple of parameters like n GPUs, x amount of memory, and then everything will work. So this is, I think, a really nice way to give this power of distributed system into the hands of people that may not love deep tech engineering. The example that we had here were actually sometimes returning, for example, in the ASR case, with the transcribed audio back to the system. In a production-grade system, you obviously would not want to do that. You might want to use the distributed I/O. And you might want to actually want to consider a multimodal feature graph engine. This is one of the projects that I'm currently also developing. It will be open source in a couple of weeks together with Daniel. So it allows you to do row-based tracking of what is going on, and you will only re-execute the rows or audio files in this particular example that have changed. So if the data scientists want to rapidly experiment, you can test the things on a subgraph and will then automatically update the full graph if you basically want to roll it out to production. And if new files come, only these new files will be updated. If you're interested, reach out afterwards. As a takeaway, I hope you can understand that Duck Lake is really powerful and simple. Maybe the ecosystem at your might need more time, but as shown before, it's really, really easy to add and integrate your own tools because it's pretty much Postgres standard SQL compliant. Asset-based orchestration solves certain challenges inside the BI and data world and analytics ecosystem, but especially also outside or as the thing that glues it all together. So you're not stuck on a single execution engine, and you can easily not just bolt on AI, but make it a native part of the process. And you can also encapsulate complexity. So via these resources, you may encapsulate the complexity of talking to external systems. And if you want to vibe code the pipeline more, the things that are really hard and tricky and that can go wrong actually are maybe not vibe coded and at least well tested, but the business logic that maybe a less experienced or less techie person will produce is, let's say, easier to be orchestrated and run in a reliable way. And you can possibly, based on this, then change the execution engine. So let's say if you are running on Spark, you may want to run on local Spark for testing, but on Databricks for convenience. But if Databricks is too expensive, you might want to retarget to EMR. You can save actually 50% of the Databricks markup for that. For really large jobs, this might be interesting for you. So the local first data ecosystem is hopefully something that you understand is a possibility and has advantages. And mainly where it can scale down to a single machine, and it can also scale as big as necessary, but with simplicity.